The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 591 for Sunday, February 7th, 2016. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, like car talk for Apple geeks, the show where you send in your questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We share it all. We try to answer your questions. The goal, of course, is to learn at least three new things each and every time we get together. Sponsors for this episode include Smile, smilesoftware.com/geek. PDF Pen is what we're talking about this week. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. New sponsor for us at Betterment, BETTERMENT.com/MGG. Online investing service. They're the first of their kind. We'll talk more about that shortly. Harry's at Harry's.com, where coupon code SHAVE5OFF saves you $5 of their off their already amazingly well-priced razors and blades. And of course, at Casper, Casper.com/MGG, where coupon code MGG saves you $50 off a new mattress. Get yourself a good night's sleep. We'll talk about that on all of it shortly here in Durham, New Hampshire on Super Bowl Sunday. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How you doing, John F. Braun?
I'm doing.
All right, good. That's good. All right, let's get into this. We got some cool stuff found. We started the last episode, the last cool stuff found episode, with something called Huff Duffer, which was a way of creating a podcast feed I'm confusing what these two things do, and I haven't even told you about it yet, of other audio files, right? Which is cool. And just random audio files that you can assemble together. Allison Sheridan over at podfeet.com, the Nozilla Cast host, told me and us this week today about Narrow, NARRO.co, which is, you can do that, but it's for text, right? So you put text articles at this thing, it text to speeches them. And I promise I won't stumble through everything today as bad as I just stumbled through that. But that's what Narrow does. And you can do some for free and some not so much for free. So that's a pretty cool one. I like that stuff. This is why we do cool stuff found. You know what I mean, John?
Cool.
Yep. Copied is what listener Steve suggests as his cool stuff found this week. He said it's copy and paste everywhere. And it's available on the App Store. It allows you to manage your clipboard on iOS, which is pretty darn cool. So I like that. That's pretty good, right? I think it's a keyboard is the way it works and the way it gets that done, which is, we like it. It's good. Fun stuff, right, John? Still moving here.
I remember a while ago.
Yeah,
it was interesting because one of our friends, I think it was our friend Don McAllister.
Yeah,
who does the screencast things. But it was funny because he, I remember, queried his base.
Yeah.
As to what they use for cut and paste. And actually, it was interesting because many people indicated that Notes is quite the current version of Notes, especially. With the upgrade that it does, more than just text now, is actually not a bad way to do cross device.
Oh,
cut and paste.
Yeah, that's actually a good idea. Yeah.
Again, especially since they before it was just text, which is kind of boring. But now, if you upgrade, you can include graphics and all sorts of other things.
Right.
So, I often use Notes to be my quick and dirty cut and paste.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Pretty cool. I like it. All right. And then Blake brings us a cornucopia of cool stuff found, if you would. Let's see. Duet, which is it. Some of these we've mentioned before, but they're worth re-mentions. Duet is one of them. It's at duetdisplay.com. You can use your iPad as an extra display for your Mac, which is really handy when you're traveling. So we will put that one into the show notes. And then Bartender, of course, I couldn't live on my laptop without Bartender at MacBartender.com, because that allows you to really tidy up the menu bar while still keeping all of your icons and apps running and all of that good stuff. Jumpsuit, which is something I'd never heard of before. Another clipboard one. This is for up to 99 items. You know, if you're not using a multiple entry clipboard, that's something to really check out, because it's life changing. Knowing that you can go and copy like four things and then go and choose which of those you're going to paste when, they all kind of stay in your multiple clipboard. So Jumpsuit's one of those things. There are others. I use Keyboard Maestro actually to do that, because I use it for some other things. And so it's there. So I've got Keyboard Maestro configured to do it. And I have, you know, Command V will paste for me from Keyboard Maestro, and then Command Shift V brings up my clipboard history. And, you know, then I can pick whichever one I want, and it uses all, menu, you know, arrow keys and stuff. So you don't have to leave the keyboard. That's what I'm trying to say. I guess I am going to stumble through some of these as much as I did the other ones, but you know, that's just how it's going to go today, I guess. Let's see. What else does Blake have for us? I know we're not done. Flux, which changes, it's kind of like Night Shift for your Mac, right? So it changes the white point of your display and makes it a lot less blue, so that you're getting less blue light at night, which is handy. And I think that's about it. Yeah, that's good enough. There's some more, but we'll leave it at that. So thank you very much, Blake, for those. These are great. It's great stuff.
Speaking of keyboards, Dave.
Yes, John.
Well, I thought I'd interject. Go. So I got something.
Yeah.
And it was actually brought to my attention. So Amazon has these things. I think they call them gold box deals or deals of the day and stuff like that. And a couple of days ago, and you can get emails alerting you to these.
Yep.
Or I think also on Twitter or various other social media. But so I noticed one, and I decided to jump on it. It was a pretty good price, because I have... Well, it's still, I can see it sitting in my pile of things that I think I'm going to bring to recycling. But the last keyboard I got, which I liked for some reasons, but then I started not to like for other reasons. Verbatim had something called a speaker keyboard. I liked it because it was a full-size keyboard and it had a backlight. It also had speakers, which I really didn't use. I just liked the keyboard. But it annoyed me for various reasons. So one, if I hit a key on it, it wouldn't wake my machine, which I thought was kind of weird. And also some of the keys didn't work right. Like it just wouldn't see certain key combinations like recovery and other things when I started my machine up. And I'm like, let me try something different.
Sure.
And so this is something that actually a few people have recommended. So I got the Logitech wireless solar keyboard K750.
All right.
And so far, I'm pretty happy. It's a pretty sweet keyboard, as the name implies. It is so it is wireless. So up until now, I have had wired keyboards.
Oh, huh. All right.
You know, USB.
Sure. Yeah, why not? Yeah.
But this one is wireless. It uses, so it's not Bluetooth. Right? It is 2.4 gigahertz, but it uses Logitech's proprietary. So they give you a little dongle.
The
you
little
plug
dongle.
It into a USB port. And
sure.
It is 2.4 gigahertz, but it's not Bluetooth and not Wi-Fi. It's their standard.
Yep.
But the cool part is that it charges itself using solar cells that are built into the keyboard.
Smart.
And so far, I haven't seen a good... It keeps saying it's at 100%, which is great, because they give you an app that not only tells you the level of the rechargeable battery in it, and they claim that at a full charge, you can type on this thing for 3 months before you're going to need to charge it again if you're not near light. What's also fun is that they have a little, it was a little annoying because their software is kind of weird in that they say, go here to get this additional piece of software that not only tells you the charge level, but it also tells you the amount of lumens that are being received by the keyboard. The only annoyance is that if you try to go to their webpage and their support page, the installer for the software isn't there. They got to get their act together. The thing is, you can get it from the App Store. Similar, the other Logitech device I have is the webcam. Okay. And that also, you can get the control software to fine-tune it from the App Store. But so far, I like it. Like I mentioned, I just leave it on all the time for now. And if I hit a key on it, it will wake my machine, which is what I would expect. And I actually tried to start up in recovery, and it actually recognized that keystroke as well. So I got it via special. This special, it was $40.
Nice.
Normally, the retail price is $60. But it's, as a touch typist, I like it. It's the layout and the feel is very similar. I would say almost exactly the same feel as the keyboard on my MacBook Pro. So something you guys may want to check out if you're considering a wireless keyboard. So far, I'm pretty happy with it.
All right. Cool. Moving on. Koji. Cool stuff found. Yandex Translate. He says, Dave, you mentioned that you are heading to Europe and in need of a translation app that you can use offline. I was in Ecuador/the Galapagos a few weeks ago, and Wi-Fi, let alone 3G, was spotty at best. I don't really know much Spanish, so I was looking for an offline translation app, and I came across Yandex's Translate app. The best part is you can use it offline, which is perfect when you have no network access. But you have to download the language library first. Similar to Google's app, you can snap a photo and it will translate the text. Although it can handle speech, you have to be connected to a network for that. Thanks, Koji. Awesome, awesome stuff. And along those lines, Bill chimes in with the iOS language dictionaries from Ultralingua. He says it's just definitions, not translation of sentences, but there are some phrases plus verb forms. So that's pretty cool. Thank you, folks, for sending those in. It means a lot. That will become very helpful as we get closer to our Europe trip coming up here. So very cool. And Patrick, with yet another cornucopia of things, he says he's got a couple of them for the iPhone. Coach's clock. If you volunteer coach a youth team, it allows you to sub kids in and out and keeps track of playing time to give everyone equal time. So we will put that one in the show notes. Mobile Day, a calendar app for conference calls. It simplifies the process. It's excellent if you make more than 2 conference calls per month. And so we'll put that one in the show notes. Those are iPhone apps. And then he's got 3 Mac apps for us too. Airmail, which actually now is also for the iPhone, and I've been testing it out, but I'm not quite ready to talk about it. It's been a little flaky for me. But it might be the mail app that replaces mail for me on the iPhone. It could be if it could just show me my freaking sent mailbox. Otherwise, I really, really like it, in fact. But Airmail is also on the Mac, and it's at airmailapp.com. So thank you for that, Patrick. Helix Express is an unknown, virtually unknown database program that is extremely clever and powerful. It's been around since the 80s and the Digital Equipment Corp days. It says it ran on a VAX, but it also runs on a Mac. So we will put that in the show notes. And finally, NovaMind and Merlin, a mind mapper and project management tools that work seamlessly together. I have never used NovaMind, but man, I have used Merlin, and I agree with you. Merlin is killer. So thank you for mentioning that. I think it's been a long time since we've mentioned Merlin on this show. And that's one of those apps that's really well built. And just if you need to do project management, that is the way to go. So thank you for all of those. Trying to think of what else we have here, John. Leon, we're going to blaze through these cool stuff found because it's what we do. Leon says, in show 589, you mentioned your love of mail plugins. The only problem is that every release of OS X seems to disable the plugins, even if they work fine. I guess I can understand as Apple is trying to be conservative. And he says, I guess this is a finger wag, not a fish shake. Anyhow, there's a handy little free tool called Mail Plugin Manager by little known software that can help you deal with this. It detects when a plugin is going to be disabled, and it will help you find an update if available. It will also let you easily re-enable disabled plugins, which is also super handy. It's got a great little feature for finding new plugins as well. And of course, he provides us to the link over at Little Known Software. That's, I agree. I've been using Mail Plugin Manager for years. This is one of those things where I use it and never think to put it in the notes, but you know, there you go. So that's how that goes, John.
Yeah. Of course, they are the maker of a utility that I think you and I both love, which is, yeah, the Signature Profiler.
Indeed. Yeah, Scott Little's a good guy, and yeah, I couldn't live without Signature Profiler. It lets you assign different signatures to different profiles, different mail addresses, something that Airmail on iOS actually lets you do. Another reason it might become one of my favorites. Yeah, so like when we're replying to Mac Geekab mail there, we can have separate signatures for, you know, the normal and the premium and all of that good stuff. So, yeah, it's good stuff. We talked about Mocha recently, John, not the chocolatey lusciousness, but the cable, the Ethernet over coax solution that works alongside of your cable signal. And Everett reminds us that some of the new Comcast modems, especially the all-in-one ones, have Mocha built in for streaming to their own cable DVRs for the on-demand stuff. But he says it's Mocha just like anything else. So if you want to connect a network in, it works just fine. And that means you don't need to buy a Mocha device for the origin point. You can just buy one for where it's going. And to that end, thank you, Everett. To that end, the TiVo Bolt, I read when I was installing my new one, that also does the same thing. It's a Mocha device in and of itself. So it'll send Ethernet over coax, which is, you know.
Okay. You beat me to it because I know that some of the TiVos, I don't know if it's just the Bolt.
It might be the Romeo too. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So they have what I'll call a Mocha transceiver or connector.
Yeah.
So, you can do high combine, which kind of makes sense. I mean, if you're going to screw a cable into it,
yeah,
it should support. It'd be nice if it supported not only tuning but networking over, and I guess it's over the same wire, right?
Yeah, it's right. It's yeah, exactly. That's kind of the way it works. It's pretty good. All right, two more left. I promise. Ian writes. He says, "I heard someone recommend City Maps to Go. I found this incredibly frustrating to use, because when you reach the edge of a downloaded map, you had to know by name the next region. So instead, I switched to using maps.me, which comes with a world map. And as you zoom into a location, once you pass the limit, it will prompt you to download the detailed map for the region. It also comes with routing information that will give you turn by turn instructions. So that's maps.me. Thank you very much, Ian. And let's see, the last cool stuff found from one of you, and then I have one of my own, but I think, this is not a cool stuff found. This is a tip from a premium listener, Jeff. And that is, here we are. He says, whether an app is available for offline, for download or not. So, okay. The setup is in show 589. We were talking about the, availability of apps that you have previously purchased that are no longer available in the App Store. And as John and I kind of discussed, some of them you can still download. And Jeff provides some clarity on these. He says, whether an app is available for you to download after it is no longer available for sale depends on how and why it was removed. If it was removed from sale, then yes, it will be available to re-download. But if it was deleted from the developer's iTunes Connect account, then it is gone forever. I don't believe there's a way for customers to know how or why it was removed other than whether or not it's available for re-download. And that makes sense. It's got to be there somewhere. So thank you for that, Jeff. Lastly, John, I tested something out this week that I messed with at CES called Earin, E-A-R-I-N at earin.com. These are wireless earbuds. And when I say wireless, I don't mean that they're Bluetooth, but connected to each other. These are truly just little wireless things, not much bigger than an earplug. And you put one in your left ear and one in your right ear, and they're Bluetooth headphones. And man, so first of all, they sound amazing. I was blown away. I thought they sounded good at CES, but it's hard to tell when you're on, like, you know, I saw him at one of those press events, so it's just kind of crazy and loud. But man, I've been using them here this week and they sound great, but there is something amazingly, it's almost bizarre not having cords, even just cords or something between the two headphones. This freedom of being unrestricted is amazing. I was using it, actually, I was using them while I snowblowed, because we got about 8 inches of snow, I guess 10 inches the other day, whatever it was. I had to clean up the edges. We have somebody plow our driveway, but I used the snowblower to do some stuff. And I was out there and used these. And man, it's so nice not having the cord like get caught on the hood of my jacket or whatever. It was, and it sounds great. So Irin, the battery will last about 3 hours in stereo mode, and then you can use them just one at a time in mono mode. And mono mode, you get about 10 hours. What's cool, though, is they come in this metal tube, and the tube is what charges them. So you pop these things into the tube and slide the tube closed, and then it's, you know, it's like a, I don't know how big it is. It's like, I don't know, maybe two or three times the size of a chapstick. It's maybe twice as long as a chapstick and a little bit thicker, you know. So it's this tiny little tube. You can keep it in your pocket. It protects them and it charges them. And then you take it out of the tube and you take them out of the tube and put them in. And the tube has its own battery in it from which it charges the headphones. And then you can charge the tube with a micro USB thing. But you get several charges out of the tube itself. So it's pretty cool. It's a very cool design. I think it's about $250, but which is not cheap. But man, for the quality that you're getting, it's actually the right price. So it's really, really, really cool. It's fun stuff. I was very impressed by them. So that's what I got there, John. You got anything else on your cool stuff found list?
Not at the moment.
Okay. Then what I want to do, if it's all the same to you, John, is I would like to talk about our first two sponsors. Does that work for you, John?
Outstanding.
All right. Our first sponsor today is a new sponsor for us here, and that's Betterment at betterment.com/MGG. Let me ask you a question. How many of us here enjoy investing? How many of us are experts at investing? How many of us are experts at getting started at investing? I am in none of those categories. There are people out there that are better at this than me. The problem is sometimes it's really intimidating to go and talk to those people, especially as you're getting started. And we all need to get started. So here's the thing. Betterment is the first automated investing service. They're the largest. They're the category leader. They've got over 100,000 customers, and they make it really easy to use. You just go to betterment.com/MGG and you start answering questions. Very simple questions. How old are you? What are your goals? How much do you make? And they're going to start putting all this stuff together for you. They make it really easy. They make it really comfortable, and you can do it at your own pace without feeling like you're being judged by anybody else. Because you're not. However, Betterment has people on staff 7 days a week if you need help. And that's the thing. They're not here to make you feel bad about what you're doing or what you're not doing. There's no hard sell tactics. Betterment is an alternative to a personal investment manager and financial advisor. They advise you on your goals and then help you achieve them. Obviously, they can't make any guarantees because nobody controls the stock market. That's not what they're there for. That's not what anybody's there for. Betterment is there to make this easy, make it lower cost than other financial services, and do it really well. You've got to get control of your finances. Betterment is the way to get started. It's never too late to begin saving for retirement or other financial goals, whatever that might be. But there's no reason for you to wait. There's no reason for me to wait. Go to betterment.com/MGG. That gets you up to 6 months of automated investing for free. And you can get more information, of course, at betterment.com/MGG. Our thanks to Betterment for sponsoring this show. I also want to talk about our sponsor, Harry's at harrys.com. You guys know this. These folks make the best razors I've ever used. I bet they're going to be the best razors you've ever used. Here's the thing, you can make it even better, right? So I'm a geek and I like iterating on the process. So there's a couple things that I've learned. And actually, I learned some of these things reading Harry's website, because Harry's, they're shaving geeks too, right? So what better match? So one of the things is, you know, you first, before you're going to put the blade to your skin, you're either going to put Harry's Great Gel or Harry's Great Cream. I actually, you know, I've got both. I do prefer the cream. It's this very silky thing, but the gel works too. And it's sometimes nice to get foamed up. Well, if you're going to do that, put it on and then wait a couple of minutes before you put the blade to your skin. That gives the gel or the cream time to soften up the whiskers on your face, time to really kind of get your skin soft, a little bit of patience. You can wash your hands. You can take some time, wash the rest of the cream or the gel off your hands. You can heat up your razor blade under some hot water, and then you start shaving. But when you start shaving, make sure you go with the grain. And it's good, even actually before you put the cream on, to go and kind of feel your face and figure out which way the grain goes at different places. Because if you're like me, it's kind of all over the place. And again, I learned all this stuff from Harry's, harrys.com. They're shaving geeks. So figure out how your face works and then shave in that direction. Then when you're finished, you can put another layer of cream or gel on and do a shave in the opposite direction. Right? That way you're not getting caught up on the big long whiskers or anything, and you can go against the grain and get a nice smooth finish on this. You got to check this out. And here's the best part. This stuff, it doesn't cost you an arm and a leg. In fact, it's the least expensive shave I've ever had, and it's the best shave. So you go to harrys.com. You can start with a kit for just, well, retail is $15, but you don't pay retail. You use the coupon code SHAVE5OFF, that's SHAVE, the number 5, OFF. You save $5. So now $10 free shipping to you. You get a handle, 3 blades, a little travel case for the blade, and either cream or gel. It's awesome. You got to check it out. Harrys.com, coupon code SHAVE5OFF. You can be a shaving geek too. In fact, send us your shaving geek tips. We'll share those too. Thanks to Harry's for sponsoring this episode. And now, John, it's time to go to Felix, because Felix has a great question. Felix says, guys, I have so many old hard drives in storage. Do you guys have any suggestions for what I could do with them? Most of them are bare SATA drives, which have been replaced, so they still have data on them. Is there any kind of enclosure that can combine all of them just to keep as backups? Something cheap that could keep them spinning once in a while to keep the magnetic data from becoming corrupted or anything like that? I would appreciate suggestions. Okay, so Felix, what you're looking to do is called JBOD, right? J-B-O-D, and it stands for just a bunch of...
Odd disks? Old disks?
No, just a bunch of disks. That's it.
Of disks.
Yeah, of disks. And that's what it is, right? You know, you're looking for something that's kind of like a RAID enclosure. In fact, many enclosures that are RAID enclosures will support JBOD as well. And it can be a really handy thing. So there's all kinds of different enclosures that I've looked around at. The Otherworld Computing has some, of course, you know, and you can get them in Thunderbolt and you can get them in variety of sizes. But what's cool is, you know, any enclosure that is built to support soft RAID, right, or software RAID, but soft RAID is a commercial product that does it, is doing it as JBOD, right? Because it's presenting all of the disks to the operating system, and then it's up to the OS to do whatever you want with it. But there's nothing stopping you from just mounting all of them separately. I found a 4-bay unit on Amazon that's just a USB 3 device, which, again, for what you're talking about, might be perfect. And it's, you know, $149. So that's we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But yeah, JBOD. And I know it's a weird term, but it's what you want.
And, you know, I believe it's I would say that JBOD is a subset of, and you mentioned RAID. Now, yeah. What is RAID? And RAID, I think some would say, stands for Redundant Array of Inexpensive Disks.
Right.
I think raid, though, implies that there's a level of integrity. Protection. Whereas JBOD, I think, is a level of raid, if you know what I'm saying, is that JBOD could be.
I think it's exactly the opposite of raid. It's like non-raid.
Oh, all right.
Right? I mean,
right. And that it's not doing anything smart in that all the drives appear as individual. Okay, because raid, at the very basic level, I think raid 0 or 1 or whatever will stitch together. We'll start doing something smart. Yeah, so JBOD is no smarts whatsoever.
Yeah, but even if you have smarts, you can I think it's raid 0, which is not really raid, right? Because it just stitches everything together and doesn't have any fault tolerance, right? Right,
and that it makes a number of drives appear as one.
Right, right.
And I would say there's some intelligence there, but it's the first step towards. And then as you progress down the raid standards, better things happen.
Yeah.
You know, raid 1, raid 5, raid 10, and then you start introducing, you know, redundancy and error correction and, you know, things that you want and you get out of commercial units, whether it be QNAP or Drobo or Synology or all that. The you know, this is something that I noticed. I don't know if you had I'll just toss it out here since we're talking about this thing. I did notice the other day when I saw QNAP at a show, they have something that I think is rather unique in that they have what I would say is kind of their proprietary. I believe you've actually evaluated QNAP units, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're like Synologies or anything like that. Yeah.
But I do believe they have one thing that I saw that was kind of unique that I hadn't seen in others is that they have, for a lot of their units, I'm not sure of all of them, but they have an enclosure that actually will accept, I think, either SATA or US, but it'll accept drives of different types and then kind of standardize it into their kind of proprietary one, which I think is kind of interesting. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'll have to look it up. But the thing is, they offer, I think, a bit more flexibility in assembling a bunch of random drives that you have in that they can be of different interface types. And then they offer the connector that then. So I guess what I'm saying is you may want to. Again, I don't have a QNAP unit, but a QNAP may be worth looking at if you're thinking of taking a bunch of drives and just throwing them together to do something cool.
Yeah, but QNAP builds network units and. Yeah, that's not what he wants
Or raiding. Okay.
He just wants to mount. It's like he wants, you know, 4 external enclosures mounted separately. And so you can do that with 4 separate enclosures, but you can also get a JBOD enclosure and just do it that way. There's been some discussion in the chat room here at MacGeekGab.com/stream. About whether JBOD requires drives to be all kind of concatenated together and treated as one. I don't believe that to be the case. In fact, I've done it and not had that be the case, but you can do that. You can, you know, once you've got all the disks, you can sort of do what you want with them. But it, like John said, it's a dumb configuration, but you can combine them into a single logical volume and make it a linear JBOD configuration as opposed to kind of what would be a parallel JBOD configuration where you've got just, you know, multiple disks presenting themselves. And that's what they do. They present themselves and then it's up to you to decide how you want to, you know, deal with them. That's right.
Right. And the other suggestion I have is if you have a bunch of drives and you're not sure what to do with them, now is as good a time as any, Dave, to learn how to juggle.
If you're going to learn how to juggle, because I did this, right? As a kid, I desperately, desperately wanted to know how to juggle. And so I learned all the mechanics of it, but I never could put it together. And then we had a house in our house in Connecticut that we lived in before this one. We had tall ceilings. You know, we had vaulted ceilings. Actually, we had vaulted ceilings in a couple of houses. But we had kids in that house. And that was really the first house where we had kids. And so we had one of these kind of ball pit things like you see it at you know, amusement centers or whatever. We had one at the house. Mm-hmm. It was much smaller than you'd see at these amusement centers, but it was there. And it had these really lightweight balls in there. And I would stand on conference calls with my phone on a headset and these 3 of these balls. And because they're so lightweight, they stay in the air forever. And it made it so easy to learn how to juggle. And now I've heard people say that you can do the same throwing like handkerchiefs in the air just to get the flow of it. You want something that has some good hang time. I'm not quite sure hard drives are what you're looking for. You probably want to get the rhythm down with something else, but now I can juggle anything. Yeah. Yeah. It's fun. I love juggling. It's really, it's like meditative. It's very, very, I love it. Anyway, I don't know. I'm nuts. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Where are we here? So that's that. Along these lines, because we like it when there's patterns to what we do here, Craig has a question. He says, I have a 27-inch iMac, and I'm looking to upgrade to a new 27-inch Retina iMac with an internal SSD of 256 gigs. What I am planning is to store all my data, photos, music, documents, everything on an external Thunderbolt array. That way, it will make future computer upgrades easy, since all the data will reside external to the computer. I don't really want a NAS drive, though. What I want is the speed of a multiple disk array, like RAID 0, I believe he says, but I also want redundancy, like RAID 1. I have around 1 terabyte of data now, so a total of 2 terabytes should be good for several years. If I've done my homework correctly, that means a RAID 5 array with 4 drives. Am I correct in that? Yes, that's correct. 3 drives minimum to make RAID 5 work the way you think it's going to work. Otherwise, it's just essentially mirroring. But yeah, he says, I assume that I will need 4 2-terabyte drives to accomplish this. Is that correct? Well, no, you could do this with 4 1-terabyte drives. What happens in RAID 5, you have 1 drive fault tolerance, right? So that means that of your 4 drives, if one of them dies, you can replace that one and not lose any data. But what it means is you're dedicating 1 drive to what's called parity, if I'm getting all my terms correct. And that means you don't have that drive's worth of storage in your entire space. But you don't have to pick the drive. That's the RAID just sort of deals with it. And that's the magic of RAID. So if you've got 4 1-terabyte drives, that's 4 terabytes of raw storage and about 3 terabytes, 1 drive less of storage available to you. So if you're thinking 2 terabytes total, then 4 1-terabyte drives in a 4-drive RAID is fine. Probably it wouldn't surprise me, though, if you start pricing out drives to find that 2-terabyte drives might be cheaper in some instances than the ones just because of the way sizes are. I haven't priced them. It's possible the ones are still cheaper. But I know that as time marches on, the smaller drives, sometimes I think you ran into this, right, John, where you went to buy a drive and it was cheaper to buy something larger.
When I wanted to upgrade or I wanted to replace a failing drive in my TiVo, and I think there was a 1 gig drive in there.
Yeah.
And I looked up the model, so I got the model number. It was a WD drive. And yes, it was less expensive for me to get a larger drive. It's, economics, supply and demand.
It's economies exactly
of
right.
scale.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And David in the chat room suggests the OWC Thunder Bay 4 RAID, which is not a bad way to go at all. You're going to be spending some money to do this, and it's important to remember that. For the 4 terabyte version, which is 4 1-terabyte drives in this 4 bay RAID, and the soft RAID software, and I'll put an asterisk on that to come back to it. It's $729. To go up to 4 2-terabyte drives, so 8 terabytes of raw storage, you're adding about $130 to $854. But the enclosures are not cheap. You're talking about Thunderbolt, which is not cheap, and then you're just talking about a RAID enclosure, which is also not cheap. So the enclosures are just shy of $500 as well. So you're spending some money here. One thing to bear in mind is that with these types of enclosures, you're talking about soft RAID, which means that it's third-party software managing the RAID. Now, I think you could use OS X's disk utility to manage the RAID. You might have to do it from the command line now. Well, the benefit to doing...
It's more a pain in the neck now, from what I understand.
You're right.
They've hidden a fish shake to them that they're hiding things, although the capabilities are still buried underneath the covers, but yep. You have to do some work. The other thing I think, and then back to you, but the thing I thought we should mention is that since we last talked about SoftRAID, they've actually come out with a version they call SoftRAID Lite. Now, the one issue some people may have had in the past is that SoftRAID was rather pricey.
Sure.
In the hundreds of dollars. They have something called SoftRAID Lite, which is $49.
Okay.
So if you're thinking of a software RAID solution, that's a lot more palatable, because I think before it was like $249 or $495. Sure. It was, you know, beyond what a lot of people want to spend for a piece of software to manage their disks.
Yeah. Now you're getting it free with that, or you're getting it included with that OWC drive that David in the chat room mentioned. But yeah, yeah, no, you're totally right. The one issue that I have with software RAID from SoftRAID versus Apple's, you're right, SoftRAID's way easier to use. It's more powerful. And I think there's been some benchmarks and it actually turns out to be faster, is that you have to have SoftRAID installed on any Mac for it to be able to access that drive. And that's not a big deal, but it is a deal. Whereas Apple's software RAID works on any OS X installation because it's baked into OS X. Yes, it's harder to set up now than it used to be, but you plug that drive into any OS X machine and it will see it. And so that's it. That there is a huge benefit to that, I think. But as many people in the chat room are mentioning, and actually as I had on my list next, a Direct Connect Drobo also is going to work here. And, you know, it manages the creation and management of the volume. So you put your disks in, you can use different size disks, right? You know, and you can use, I would argue that you probably don't need Thunderbolt for what you're talking about. I don't know. You know, you mentioned photos, music, documents, everything. There wasn't a whole lot of, you know, video production data that just has, you know, massive bandwidth requirements. So a USB Gen 3 Drobo, man, might be exactly what you're looking for and is, you know, very inexpensive. I think it was $299. We had that coupon code for a while. I don't know if it's still good. You'd have to look back in the show notes because I don't remember it off the top of my head, but I think it was either Geek 100 or MGG 100. Saved you $100 off of that. So, you know, a USB Drobo might be plenty fast for you because it's all USB 3. And then it just works. You plug it in and it presents itself as an OS X volume, or you format it. But then once you've done that, then you like you can plug it into any machine. And those Gen 3 Drobos are awesome. But they also do have the Drobo 5D, which is a Thunderbolt. It's a 5-bay, not a 4-bay, Thunderbolt-based Drobo as well. So I think that might actually be a better option for you, to be perfectly honest. That's my thoughts anyway. John, anything last?
No, I'm still using my Drobo FS.
Well, that's a network Drobo, but yeah. Yeah.
Yes, but you know, I think it has, you know, pretty much the same feature set, and yeah, and I think you and I have concluded, or at least my position on the Drobo is, you know, they've gotten better with the app support, but they're what they call, I think they call it Smart RAID, did they call it, or what? I
forgot. Well, okay, so now we've kind of taken this and turned it into a mess. Just to separate it out, no apps on the Direct Connect Drobos, either the 5D or the Gen 3 Drobo. Those are just Direct Connect. They're not right. Smart devices. The only Drobos, in fact, the only Drobos that support apps are the network Drobos. So the FS, which is discontinued and you can't get it anymore, or much better than the FS, the 5N, which is currently available and actually is a fine little device, does support apps. The apps that are available for it are limited and it's sort of clunky, but it works. If you're going to do apps on a NAS, you're way better off with Synology, these days, but it's doable to do on the Drobo, but the FS is sort of a, you know, that was sort of a big failure in many, many ways. It works, but apps wise was a kind of a disaster.
I don't run apps on it.
Right.
No, Synology is mine. No, yeah. And it's called a Beyond RAID.
Beyond RAID.
It's their proprietary and I think rather clever, use of RAID, where you can, and actually I think you can even, you know, say I would like either single drive or double drive protection.
That's correct. That's right.
And, you know, for people that are looking for RAID and don't want to think about it, because it can get kind of technical if you're deploying it yourself.
Yeah, totally.
I still think the Drobo is pretty darn cool for that.
The direct attached Drobos are the simplest answer. Especially, I mean, you know, Craig's question is like poster child for a direct connect Drobo. I really, you know, I wanted to talk through all of this stuff because it's handy to understand the technical stuff behind it. But then when you come out the other end, it's like, but the Drobo is the right thing. Because then you're just not, like you said, it takes care of that headache for you. And in many cases, it's a lot less expensive. So, yeah, it's good stuff. Really good stuff. Yeah. Fun. All right, John. I want to get into some router stuff. But first, I want to talk through our second two sponsors, if, in fact, that's okay with you.
I think it is. Go.
All right. Smiles PDF Pen is one of my favorite pieces of software ever. It's not something I use every day, but it's probably something I use. In fact, it's definitely something I use at least once a week, if not more. And there's all kinds of things that I can do with it. The first thing is putting my signature on stuff. And the nice part is they've got a library in there where you can store not only your signature, but I store my name. Because oftentimes when you sign a form, it says print your name here. I put that in there. I've got like a little snippet where I can drag in and type the date in. That part's easy. And they make it super easy. And they also make it super easy to do on my phone because that library can be synced. So I've signed contracts on my phone. In fact, I remember one contract, a contract that is still in existence today. It's with one of the publishers that we represent over at Backbeat Media. I signed it waiting in the line at the gate before they started boarding the plane. You know how United has those, like if you're in, you know, priority or whatever, you get in this line and go in that line. I was in that line. I was just hanging out waiting for this flight to board. I signed a contract right there, PDF pen on my phone. Couldn't have done it without it. Works really well, but you can also do other stuff. Like if you have a PDF and it's got an error in it or text you simply want to change, you can change it. You can actually edit the text of a PDF. That's mind-blowing. They make it easy. It's just right there. You just click the tool, highlight the text, type in your revision, correction, whatever it is, and you're done. PDF Pen Pro takes it to a whole other level. Ever wanted to create a PDF from a website, like an actual PDF, not some thing that OS X like chops up and does the wrong way? PDF Pen Pro 7 does it the right way. You ever fill out PDF forms? You can do that in PDF Pen. You can make those forms in PDF Pen Pro. So now you can be the one generating those forms and giving them to other people to fill out. PDF forms are super easy for everyone to deal with. Now you can create them and make it super easy for all the people you're working with. They work perfectly with El Capitan. You got to check it out. Visit smilesoftware.com/geek. Go get your copies of PDF Pen for your Mac and your iOS devices. You're going to love it. Our thanks to Smile for sponsoring this episode. You want to have a good night's sleep. I want to have a good night's sleep. I want you to have a good night's sleep. Casper is our sponsor that's going to help you get there. The first thing you do is you visit casper.com/MGG. You don't want to forget that because that link and its associated coupon code MGG are worth $50 to you. You almost don't need the $50, though, but there's no reason not to use it. So use it. Casper.com/MGG, coupon code MGG. Because Casper's mattresses are not only fantastic, but they're fantastically priced. They're really, really fairly priced. You know, in our house, Casper was not the first foam mattress that we got. We had had a foam mattress prior. In fact, we bought it several years, but not too many years before we got a Casper mattress here. And we still have both in the house. And my wife was laying on one and then the other. And she's like, holy smokes, you know, this Casper mattress, the other one's fine, but this Casper mattress is super comfortable. I'm like, yeah, I know. She said, it's just the right amount of firm, but not too firm. And man, this is great. And here's the thing. We bought that other mattress maybe a year and a half before we got the Casper one. Casper king size mattress retail, $950. Okay. You save 50. We've already been through that. This other mattress that we bought from like the cheapest priced furniture store around here that everyone knows was about $1,200. And we had to pick it out in the store and lay on it in our clothes and all of that. We, you know, Casper gives you 100 nights free trial, which means you buy the mattress, but if you don't like it within that first 100 nights, they come and get it for you and give it all your money back. So there's no risk to you. You got to check this out. Casper.com/MGG, coupon code MGG. Like I said, $950 is the retail price for a king. Everything else is less than that. And you save $50 anyway, free shipping. What more is there to say? Check it out. Casper.com/MGG, coupon code MGG. Our thanks to Casper for sponsoring this episode. All right. If we haven't gotten geeky enough, buckle in. Buckle up, because it's about to get started. Maybe not, though. We try to kind of dissect these things. So I've said it on the show that certainly for us, and I think for the world at large, 2016 is the year of the router. I know we all already have routers, so that might be a weird thing to say, but it's the year that the router really starts to do some smart things that help us in our quest for faster, more reliable Wi-Fi. And there's a couple of, and really just faster and more reliable internet connections. So there's two technologies that I want to talk about today. One of them is called airtime fairness, and the other is quality of service, or QoS. And there's other technologies to talk about, but we'll limit it down to these two for this little segment here. So airtime fairness, John, is an interesting thing. We've talked for years. We've talked about how when 802.11g came on the scene, right? We talked about how, well, 802.11g theoretically supports up to 54 megabits per second. Really, you get half that. But if you have older 802.11b clients on your network, that can slow those down. And then that everybody got all wavy-armed about that, right? Like, well, it doesn't actually slow them down to those speeds. It's just that sometimes, you know, if they're transmitting, it can slow things down. But nobody ever, at least it was never explained to me, and therefore we never explained to you because we didn't know why that actually happened. But it kept happening, right? 802.11n, same thing. Oh, but if you've got G devices, you know, it gets yada, yada. You want to keep those. You want to isolate them. Here's why. The way radios work, and again, this is another thing we're going to talk about here down the road. The wireless radios work is currently they can only talk to one client at a time. Now that's not quite true because we've got this whole MU MIMO, which is multi-user MIMO thing where you can split your streams up and have them talking. But most clients don't support that yet. And most routers don't support that yet. So routers can talk currently to one device at a time. And the way they decide when they're finished talking to one device is they tell each device that that device gets to send X amount of data. And when that device is finished sending X amount of data, it says, okay, wait till your next turn, next. And it goes to the next one. Now think about this. If you've got your network up and running and you've got one device that's 802.11n, and let's say it's got, you know, maybe 185 megabit per second range based on its distance to the router and all of that stuff. And you've got another device that's 802.11g, that's getting, you know, maybe 25 at best, right? Megabits per second. Well, if each of them gets to send the same amount of data, who gets to wait? Well, the faster one has to wait, right? The faster one is going to transmit the same amount of data faster than the slower one. So that's what can slow down a network. If you've got multiple clients competing for the radio, the slower one takes longer. So there's this technology out called airtime fairness. And what it does is it changes the decision point from being about data to being about time. And it says, fine, if you turn on airtime fairness, now each client, no matter their speed, gets to transmit for the same amount of time before we move on to the next one. And it's just a round robin thing or something along those lines. which means your slower clients get slower if they're competing for time with the faster ones. If there's no faster ones that want to talk, well, then, you know, your client just gets to go. But if there's other people that want to talk, that's what airtime fairness is. So in most cases, you probably want it on, especially if you're in a scenario where you've got mostly 802.11n or faster if you've got AC devices or whatever. But you might have that one or two devices that are still G, like, you know, maybe your Wi-Fi thermostat or something like that, you know.
Nest.
Yeah, Nest, right. Yeah, exactly. But it's fine. They don't need to be N devices, right? G is fine for those. Sonos is all G. It doesn't need to transmit.
I would say ideally, you want everybody at the highest.
Well, yeah, level. But the reality is you don't get to control that.
Yeah, like you said.
Yeah.
You know, like I upgraded my TiVo from a G to an N because I wanted it to be part of the N club and not
right.
be the, you know, the bad.
Yeah.
Or the thing that's not dragging everybody down necessarily, but just, you know, the
potentially.
Odd,
yes.
Odd man out and just causing, because actually I've set, and, you know, this is probably a good thing to do if your router allows you, is to exclude the bands that are
sure.
Like, for example, I've set mine up and I say no B devices.
Right.
No, nobody. And actually, I think even now, I think I am a N only household. I don't believe I have any G devices. So sure. I think I've actually, but no, I've definitely set up my TP-Link, and I think you can do this with Apple as well. I've definitely set it up to say no B whatsoever.
Right.
Just don't allow it. And I may have set it up to disallow G because, again, I'm pretty sure I don't have any G devices anywhere. Right. They're all N.
Yeah, but that you don't. Oftentimes, you don't get to pick, right? You're going right. to wind up with some devices that are just that way. And so airtime fairness just sort of deals with it. And it says, nope, no problem. And then your fast devices just get to be fast. Now, the catch is your router, and this is a router technology. It doesn't need a client-side version, you know, piece of it. It's all in the router, but your router needs to support it. Apple's routers, to my knowledge, do not support airtime fairness. They could. I think they could. I'm pretty sure the radios, certainly in the latest crop of AirPort Extremes, can do it. It's just not turned on. And I don't think there's an option in the GUI for it. But there are in a lot of the new routers that are out. I think your TP-Link has it. I know your TP-Link's radio supports it if you're using third-party firmware. But I think it's in there and it's in, you know, Netgear's doing it and it's out there. So that's airtime fairness. Any questions on that before we move on to the next one, John?
Not yet. I think I get it. So that's the first level of.
Yeah, sure.
How the routers handle this, which is, you know. Yeah. Very basic and very simple and kind of makes sense.
But it makes sense. Yeah. It's like, I mean, you know, you got to pick something to use to limit it. And initially they picked.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, like you said, it's like, okay, you talk.
That's it.
You're kind of slow. All right. But I'll let you talk.
Yeah. Yeah. Now here's something. It is worth, again, I just want to mention briefly this MU-MIMO or MU-MIMO is how the router community discusses it. MU-MIMO is the technology. So you might have a router that supports, you know, you see this like 3x3 or 4x4, right? It's got multiple streams per radio, right? And for 2.4 gigahertz, each stream of the radio is at 802.11n, 150 megabits per second. So if you've got a three stream radio, that's 450 megabits per second. And when you start adding up all these numbers, that's how router manufacturers get to, you know, AC1700 or AC1900 or anything like that. But the client device needs to support that number of streams too. So if you have a four stream router, but your client device only supports two streams, well, now it's a two stream router when it's talking to that client. And it'll pick the right two streams to get it the best signal. But those other two streams go unused while you're just, you know, while it's talking to that client. If you have two stream devices, it seems like a waste that, hey, wait a minute, there's these other two streams on the router that are waiting to be used because that client is tying up the entire radio. That's what's called SU-MIMO, single user MIMO. And that's what most of our routers support. But there's new routers coming out and some new client devices, too. And we'll see more of those this year that support what I mentioned before, multi-user MIMO or MU-MIMO. And that means that, yes, if you've got one device that has two and another device that has two and your router supports four, guess what? Your router gets to talk to both at the same time. But it has to be supported in both the router and all of the clients in order for that to happen. So it'll take a little while, but we're getting there. So that's MU-MIMO, MU-MIMO. Make sense? All right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So now it's time to talk about quality of service. And this is actually something that many routers, again, not Apple's, sort of, have had for a long time. And the idea behind quality of service is this. If you're using 100% of your router's bandwidth in either direction, either down or up, other traffic is going to be impacted. Other traffic is going to be slowed down. So the idea, and this is a very basic sort of description of QoS. I know we could get deeper. We'll get a little deeper. So the idea is, what if your router was smart enough to say, hey, guy doing the big upload to Dropbox over there, somebody else just wants to check email. So I'm just going to slow you down a little bit and let their email traffic through. That's a good thing, right? Because now the guy checking email has no idea that somebody's soaking the upstream with their iCloud photos upload, which you might not even know is happening, or Dropbox, which, again, you might not know is happening, or your online crash plan backups, that kind of thing. It can really slow you down. The same is true in the other direction. If you're downloading gobs and gobs of data for whatever reason, it can slow you down. And the reason is your pipe from the cable company or your internet pipe is only so fast. And when you soak it all up, you can't get other data through, so data has to wait, right? And the buffers fill up, and that's what slows things down. It's called buffer bloat, if you want to look up the term. But it kind of makes sense. I don't think you need to look at them. So the idea behind quality of service is, if your router were to know how fast your cable modem connection was, well, then it could know, hey, that client is sending data that's at our cap, so we better just slow them down a little bit to leave some headroom for everybody else and manage the data, the connection appropriately. And that's what quality of service does. QoS is what routers call it. Again, Apple's routers don't have any way of configuring this. All routers do some level of this anyway, but without knowing and being explicit about what your connection speed is, they can't do it properly. And so you have to tell your router what your connection speed is. But and here's the hard part, and it's a hard pill to swallow. You know, you do your speed tests or whatever on your connection when nobody else is using it. And, you know, here, you know, I get, let's say I get 160 megabits down and 12 megabits per second up. That's about what I get. In order for quality of service to work, you have to make sure that you never hit the max speed of your cable modem's connection. So you have to tell your router to slow everybody down and to limit your speed to be about 95% of what your cable connection is. And it's hard to give up that 5%. It's a theoretical thing, right? Exactly. Yeah. So you have to buy into this, but here's a way to convince yourself. Cause I did this week. I set up QoS on our router, recently. I finally bit the bullet. My son's playing some online games. We've got a lot of stuff going on. I thought, yeah, you know what? And I only did it on the upstream. My router allowed me to do it just on the upstream. So I set my upstream. We get 12. I set it to like 11.2. And it makes a huge difference. If, you know, I'm doing an upload of the show here, nobody is impacted. It just works great. But I didn't set it on the downstream because I thought, well, I don't want to give up my, you know, monster downstream. Well, I did a test the other day, and this is the test that you should do too. Open up a terminal window, type ping space www.apple.com, because Apple will respond to pings. And this is handy. And just hit enter. And it's just going to start pinging. To stop this, you hit control C, but you don't want to stop it. But that's how you stop it eventually. And it's just going to show you. And it's going to show you a readout, and the rightmost figure is going to be the number of milliseconds. What this is doing is it's sending a signal to apple.com and waiting for it to come back. Okay, very simple test. And you'll get it in a number of milliseconds. Now, for me, I was getting about 20 milliseconds. Great.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm doing it now, and I'm getting about 10 to 12.
Yeah, you've got it. You're better off than me. Yeah. But Yeah, so there's going to be some baseline, and you just got to, you know, let it run for a good 30 seconds and just get a feel. It's not going to be, like John said, he's getting about 10 to 12. I say I get about 20, but it's going to fluctuate. You're going to see a 15. You're going to see a 25 here.
And even more interesting is that to add, which I think is useful. I don't want to interrupt you. Well, I like to sometimes, but I was actually pinging an Akamai because when I said you're not pinging Apple.com.
Right.
When I stopped, it actually said, oh, well, you were actually talking to e6858.dscc.akamai.edge.net.
Right. Yeah, which is fine.
Probably because I have an Akamai closer to me probably than you. That's why I'm getting slightly better.
That's probably true. Yeah, that's right.
But go on, my friend.
No, that's right. But what you want to do is just get this going and get a baseline, get a feel for what happens. Now go to your favorite speed test site. I'm a Comcast user, so I go to speedtest.xfinity.com, but you could go to speedtest.net, whatever you want to go to, and run that speed test. The first thing it's going to do is it's going to do its own ping test to some other server, some speed server. That's fine. Then it's going to do a download test where it downloads data as fast as it can for, you know, what, about 10 seconds. And then it's going to do an upload test where it does the same thing. Watch those pings to apple.com during that test. If, like, you know, like I said, I had set up QoS on my upstream, but not my download, because I thought, well, it's not going to really matter. During the speed test downloads, my ping time to Apple doubled. I was at 40 milliseconds. Now, that's still not bad. But during the uploads, it stayed at 20 because I had QoS on. I thought, yep. So this is telling me I need to turn on QoS. So I went and turned on QoS on my router. I did the calculations based on what the speed test was. I multiplied it by 95%. That's what I put in my router. I bit the bullet. And then I did more ping tests. Sure enough, 20 milliseconds the whole time through. Because it was intelligently saying, nope, we're not going to let too much data through so that everybody can have a nice, snappy internet connection. Now, QoS can go beyond that, right? And instead of just limiting the cap, like I said, it can be very intelligent. Depending on your router itself might just, like Netgear's routers are pretty cool about this. They'll do the speed test inside the router itself, so you don't even need to do it. But then they also have a file that they get from Netgear servers that, like, tells it, okay, for, you know, a Skype call, prioritize it really high. For an FTP upload, prioritize it really low. For Xbox gaming, prioritize it high because you want that low latency for that, you know, that kind of thing. So you don't have to think about it. Some of the routers require you to be entirely manual about it. And then you've got to start being very meticulous and saying, okay, this, that, the other, you know, that's all that depends on your
question.
Router.
That was one of my questions to you in our pre-show or just our ongoing discussion about this is, the way to define who should be able to do what, I believe is, I think you pointed out, there are standards around it. It can range anywhere from something which, based on what you're telling me, is kind of smart, is that it's aware of the network that it's on and kind of prioritizes. Or you could say, all right, I'm going to allow this. And I think even my TP-Link, I looked at the QoS part and it's like, okay, you can say, all right, allow up to this amount of bandwidth for this service and this amount of bandwidth for this service. But, you know, that gets tedious and pain in the neck.
You can do more than that, though. You should be able to just set priorities, right? Where you say, like for me, I've set Dropbox and FTP and Apple iCloud, you know, traffic as bulk, right? So this is the lowest priority traffic on my network. It's great. If nothing else needs the bandwidth, by all means, give it to it. But then there's, you know, there's like a 1 through 5 kind of priority level. And so that's set all the way down at a 1. And then I've got like our Skype connection here set at a 5 that I want 100%. You know, if we're doing this show, I don't want any problems. So I set it to 5 and, you know, and so then it'll prioritize it over that. Crash plan set down at a 1, same kind of, you know, thing. Really, I'm setting things at 1 or 5. This whole thing in the middle, you know, that you could be, like you said, you could get sort of obsessive about it and it would be very tedious, but it works really well. And I like it. But again, not every router will do it that way. Some say you have to do it by client, like, you know, set that computer to be priority high, set this to be priority low. That's a little bit it's not granular enough. But I've seen that done. So Apple's routers do not offer this. They could. They have the hardware. They have the it does take a decent CPU in your router to do quality of service well, especially with fast, you know, 100 megabit plus connections. But it's doable.
Oh, wow.
You just need to be, you know, it needs to have a CPU. That's why a lot of manufacturers are pushing these, you know, dual core routers on people. It's like, why do I need a dual core CPU? Well, right. You know, my router, my router is a dual core. So I'm running that Netgear X8 right now, which is their, you know, $400 retail. It's the Netgear 8500, R8500 is the model number. But the CPU, and so it's got a dual core 1.4 gigahertz CPU in it, and it is running, the load of it is 0.7, which means that it's, you know, essentially running at 70% of its capacity. And a huge part of that is quality of service. If I turn off QoS, I'm down at like, you know, 0.1 or 0.2 kind of thing. On that. Actually, no. Because it's a dual core CPU, 2.0 would be the you know, kind of the both CPUs are maxed out. More than that means that there's processes queuing. So 0.7 means that I'm, you know, just below 50% of the CPU. Yeah. But still.
Yeah, I'm looking here, and yeah, it can get complex because I'm looking at the TP-Link screen right now on my QoS.
Yeah.
And so it has three priorities: high, 60%, middle, 30%, low, 10%. But then when I say add a rule, then it gets, as we've been saying, tedious. It's like, well, do you want to set this rule by device or by application?
Yeah, application is what you want in most cases. Although,
right, like you're saying, Skype or yeah. Backblaze or whatever, if it's something you can identify on a certain port.
Yeah, well, there's more to it than just ports. So
actually, you know, I'm looking, oh gosh, now I just clicked on application. It's showing me, oh gosh, a boatload of things. And actually, I could define my own, but it's showing me SSH, Telnet, VPN. I think there's Skype in here. Oh my gosh, GTalk.
Yeah.
Wow, this is pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And Brian Monroe in the chat room.
Well, but but I can see how it gets tedious. It's like how I don't even. I mean, you've obviously spent some time thinking about this, but I'm looking at this now. Number one, I'm the only person using my network. So.
It's different when there's only one person. No, it's true, right? You know, there's a good chance, although not a guarantee, there's a good chance that you know all of the traffic that's happening. But it could be that you've got a crash plan backup or a Backblaze, you know, something like that. Or, you know, your phone's going to decide now's the time to blast up those 45 pictures you took while you were out. And I'm just going to soak your upstream. Don't worry about it. You know, so, you know, I've got maybe 10 things in mind, right? I've got Skype three times and I don't know that I even need that. And BitTorrent is set low. iCloud, Dropbox, FTP are low. iMessage, FaceTime is high. Netflix is high. Xbox is high. YouTube is high. Amazon Video is high. And SIP, because we use AT&T, AT&T Wi-Fi for our calling with our phone. So SIP is the protocol, so that uses
session initiation protocol, I think.
Is sure. SIP, I think that's right. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So that's set to high. And those are the, you know, it's the things that are set to high are the reasons you might want this. If you're doing a lot of Skype calling, you and I do every week, and I do it with other podcasts as well. iMessage, we use FaceTime quite a bit in the house, and SIP for, you know, our phone calls we use. So there's a reason to have it. And it's nice to be able to have, you know, like I said, my son's doing some online gaming now. It's important to have that Xbox stuff, be able to pass through and get the low latency. There's not a whole lot of traffic there, but, you know, it needs to happen quickly. And the same with like Netflix. You just, you know, if you're going to watch a movie, you don't want it to be bogged down because somebody decided it was time to update, you know, to El Capitan on their machine. So it's fun stuff. It's fun stuff. It gets a little crazy, but hopefully it makes sense. And it, you know, now that I've gone a couple of days after I've, limited my bandwidth, I'm able to sleep at night again, even though I'm only using 95% of my bandwidth and not 100, but I know that the network runs faster. I mean, I saw it, and that was really the helpful thing, is seeing that ping trail going, during speed tests, you know, when I know I'm soaking up the thing. I was like, yeah, I got to do this. It's the right thing. So anyway. That's what I got there. There are other things that routers do to try and kind of QoS on their own. These things called, like, there's different protocols, transmission protocols, like Westgate and Vegas and all these other things. But
okay.
But
because
yeah,
Because I think the default behavior, and actually you may have seen this, but I've actually seen this Verizon commercial. And I think it describes exactly the default state of most networks is it shows a room full of people. And they're trying to use this to demonstrate that their network is better, which you may or may not believe. But so they show a whole room full of people, and then all of a sudden the door opens and everybody's like, yay, let's all. And the problem is there's way more people than can fit through the door. So it gets to be kind of chaos, which I think is the default state of most routers.
Right.
Everybody tries to pile through something that is of a size that is smaller than the amount of things that want to get through it.
That's right.
And then it can be bad. Whereas if you tell everybody, and I guess this is what QoS does, is like, okay, everybody get in a line, okay?
Right. Right. That's what it does.
Here, yeah. You go here. Yeah. You go here.
And oh, this guy just showed up. He's next. He's a VIP. You know, it's just how it works.
Otherwise, it's a dog pile, and dog piles are fun, you know, don't get me wrong, for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun.
If you're a dog.
I would say, I've never seen TP-Link, so I can't speak to that, but of the routers that I've tested, and I've been testing a lot, I got one of the new Synology routers just this week, so I haven't had enough time with it, but I'm really stoked about it. But so far, Netgear's QoS interface is the best that I've seen because as long as you don't want to get crazy and granular, although I guess it would do that too, but they've got that automatic file that you download that where they've kind of done all of the obvious things. And that's really, you know, unless you're doing something crazy, being able to just say, yeah, go get this file that, you know, Netgear updates a couple times a year. That's it. And then you're basically saying, turn on QoS, run the speed test, which they run inside the firmware. And then you just accept it and it's done. And I've tested it and it works, you know, Netgear's done a good job, but other people have too, but they're my current favorite. So,
well, like I say, TP-Link, you may want to pick one of these up I mean, yeah. Like I told you, I mean, this thing was, I think around $100.
Yeah.
And you know, for the money, you know, the Archer series, I think, you know, a lot of, you know, the people in our circle I know are really happy with it.
Oh, and, no, everybody loves them. Yeah.
And it's way less expensive than Apple. And you know, you can either do DDWRT or use their built in. And from what I just saw while we were doing the show.
Yeah.
Their settings look to be pretty fine grained. I personally haven't yet felt a need to implement them because I've never been in a situation where I'm like, oh, man, what I want to do on the network isn't working.
Right.
And I suspect it's because somebody else is chewing my bandwidth. The only time I think I've seen that, Dave, but then I think it's not me, it's YouTube, is sometimes I'll try to fire up a YouTube video, but then YouTube will identify the problem as being my ISP saying, okay, well, yeah, they're throttling you because.
Yeah, there's a lot of ISPs cache YouTube content in a weird way. And if you're using a non ISP based DNS, like you might be with OpenDNS, then that can actually cause some problems with YouTube because they throttle the bandwidth between the ISP and YouTube for videos that they know they have cached, right? And so that's where that issue is. Sometimes, yeah, it gets weird because YouTube, you know, they have arrangements to make sure it's like a very intelligent edge caching is what's going on. It's not like the ISPs are doing something funny. They're actually trying to do something very intelligent, but you're bypassing it. Yeah. But
isn't it funny how the ads always play beautifully. In the highest quality?
Yeah, that's right.
And then the content itself.
Well, it's quality of service, right? I mean, YouTube can do it on their end too. They can say, okay, these things get prioritized, this stuff to that IP. No, because they should have it on an edge server near them, you know, so... Anyway, hey, one more thing, and I'm just going to throw this out there. I was setting up actually a Netgear router for a friend yesterday. He had this old like 802.11g router, and he's like, yeah, the people, he rents an apartment. He has like an apartment next door to his house that he rents out. He's like, they're not getting enough signal over there. I'm like, dude, this thing is like, you know, whatever. It seems like 10 years old. He's like, yeah, that sounds about right. So we set him up with an R7500 from Netgear that, you know, dual radio, multi-stream thing, and his tenant's gone this weekend, so we don't know quite how it's working. But we had this weird thing. So we set it up and we gave the Wi-Fi network the same name and passwords that he was using previously, because why not? You know, and that's no problem. So we set them all up. We set them up with QoS and did all that good stuff because his kids play games and, you know, all that. And all the computers were working and I'm about to walk out the door. And I mean, he didn't pay me. I did this for free for him, but it was just like it would be, you know, like in the days when I would do a lot of consulting, and you folks who do consulting know how this is, right? You're done with the client. They've signed the bill. They paid the bill. You're saying goodbye. You're about to walk out the door and one of his sons comes downstairs and he's like, I'm getting really slow downloads from one of my games. I'm like, okay. Yeah, let's take a look. Now, I mean, obviously I wasn't getting paid, so it didn't matter that I had already, you know, basically packed everything up. So we go upstairs. Long story short, about 3 hours later, maybe 2 hours later, we finally figured it out. He really was getting low speeds, but we troubleshot it. And I finally, I don't know, something told me to turn on IPv6. And what was weird was IPv6 connections from his computer were totally fine. But IPv4 connections from that one computer, big problems. So it's not the hardware, right? It's not the distance from the router because it was a Wi-Fi connection. It's like, this is really weird. And so we'd restart the computer and all of that. No, same problem. And we just went round and round. And it was a Windows machine. So we're like, you know, Windows gets weird with like all the firewalls and everything. So it's like, okay, let's turn off all the firewalls. Maybe something's filtering IPv4 traffic. And no. Finally, I just manually changed his IPv4 address. So it was like 192.168.1.12 is what it was getting from the router. I changed it to like .151. Boom. Everything was golden. Totally fine. Like, okay. So what was going on? So without rebooting the router, which I'm sure now would have solved this problem, I just told it, okay, go back and get an IP address from the router, which it did. And it got .12 again. And then everything worked. So I have no idea why that was a problem. My guess is there was something in the routing tables of the router. Maybe he connected like while we were changing some settings or something, you know, who knows what the kids did, but it was just a weird thing. So I throw that out there so that hopefully nobody else has to spend those 2 hours. If you run into a scenario like that, just reboot the router. It's probably going to fix it. So it's weird. It wasn't a DNS thing. I mean, we tried all kinds of different things. Just wouldn't let traffic out. But I could get traffic to the router. Like, I could pull up the router's interface, lickety-split, over the IP. I don't know. It was weird. I can't guess this. Like I said, I think it was just something in the routing tables and changing it, you know, having the MAC address assigned to a different IP and then coming back was enough to flush out whatever needed to happen. You got any thoughts on that one, John?
As I say in my social media profile on many sites, my advice in this case would be, do you try turning it off then on again?
Well, yeah, I tried turning the computer off and on. That was the thing. The router was working with everybody else, right? So it took a long time for me to finally say, well, maybe it's the router, you know. Oh, it's weird. But it was fun, you know, and I was hanging out with a friend. And I mean, it was actually, if I wasn't with him, I probably would have been like, I don't know, shoveling extra snow or something at home. So it was good, but it was weird.
I threw down the ice melt, yo.
Yeah, we don't use a lot of that here. The sun does a pretty good job for most of our
stuff.
Well, I
do a bit because, well, though we did have some black ice situations.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of that around here.
And just a note to my fellow citizens, will you just brush your car off? Oh, my gosh. We actually put a law in place that you shouldn't have to do this. You would think people would be smart about this. But can you brush the ice and snow off your car before you drive so you don't endanger the person behind you?
Yeah.
Seriously. They've had to institute a law here because there were so many, in my opinion, dumbasses who wouldn't do this.
You know what I say to those people, John? I say feedback@macgeekgab.com is the address that you can send in your questions, your tips, your cool stuff found, and heck, even your rants. We welcome them.
You know what? Other than telling him to just clear your car, I would agree with you that No, I don't know why it would help, but yeah. I mean, after you clear off your car, send an email to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
That's feedback@macgeekgab.com. Unless you're a premium listener, like Felix and Craig were in this show. And I believe in our Cool Stuff Found, we had, I believe Jeff was a premium member as well. Thank you to all of you. And you get to use premium at MacGeekGab.com, which is, we love you for that. So if you want to,
because
if you
I'm sure
learn about
all
that,
our premium members clear off their vehicles before driving.
That's right.
Thank you for, and if you don't, you should.
Thanks for shaming all of our listeners, John. 206-666-GEEK is the phone number that anyone can use. And John, geek is?
After you've cleared off your vehicle, 4335.
Please visit us on Facebook, facebook.com/, just go to macgeekgab.com/Facebook. It's easier to get there, and then we'll approve you into the group. It's a great group that we've got there. It's actually a public group, so you can see everything, but I think in order to post, you need to be approved. But there's lots of us that can approve you, because anyone in the group can do so. So you get approved pretty quickly, and we'd love to have you over there. It's like the show goes on all week long over there with everybody chit-chatting and helping one another. It's a fantastic community. And we started the show with Allison. I'm going to end it with her. Thank you to Allison for years ago for convincing me that we needed to start groups like that Facebook group and our Google Plus group, because it really makes a difference. So thank you, Allison, for driving that point home with me. You got to check out her podcast at podfeet.com. I also want to thank CashFly at cashfly.com, CACHFLY. That is the company they provide all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. The podcast marketplace, as we mentioned during the show, Betterment at betterment.com/MGG. Harry's at harrys.com, where coupon code SHAVE5OFF saves you $5. Smile at smilesoftware.com/geek. Tells you all about PDF Pen. And of course, Casper at casper.com/MGG, where coupon code MGG saves you $50. Also, Gazelle at gazelle.com, where you can sell off all your old stuff. Amazing, where coupon code MGG saves you 20%. Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG, where MGG saves you 10%. Otherworld Computing. We mentioned some of their stuff during the show, but that's only because they make good stuff. They are also a sponsor, MacSales.com, and Barebones Software at barebones.com. Thanks for everything this week, folks. You rock. Send us your stuff, and have a good day, and don't get caught.
Made up.